Good morning. It is a pleasure for me to be with you again today. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to introduce you to one of our worthy Unitarian forebears, Theodore Parker. When Frederick Douglass visited Florence, Italy in 1887, the first thing he did was to visit the grave of Theodore Parker at the Protestant cemetery there. He was saddened to see the sorry condition of the gravesite and arranged to have the noted American sculptor William Wetmore Story create a more suitable monument. Below a bas-relief of Parker's head is the inscription, "The Great American Preacher. His name is engraved in marble, his virtues in the hearts of those he helped to free from slavery." Few people today have heard of Theodore Parker, much less recognize the important contributions he made not only to Unitarian Universalist theology and worship, but also to our national discourse. As a Unitarian minister in Boston during the 1850s, he drew as many as 25,000 people to hear him preach every Sunday. His sermons and lectures were often printed and widely distributed. He was also a noted social activist who spearheaded numerous reforms, advocating an end to capital punishment and the incarceration of oppressed and marginalized people, urging the improvement of working conditions and better wages for laborers, agitating for women's rights and humane treatment of immigrants and the poor and mentally ill, and attacking the predatory practices of what he called the merchant class. Of these many reforms, none were more important to him than the abolition of slavery. For Parker, there was never enough time, never enough hours in the day or night to accomplish all he set out to do. As a youth on the family farm near Lexington, Massachusetts, he worked 12 hours a day plowing and building rock walls. In spare moments, he read all the books he could beg or borrow. By the age of 11, he could read Latin and Greek. Still in his teens, he learned French and Spanish, and while a student at Harvard, taught himself 10 more languages, including Icelandic, Persian, and Anglo-Saxon. Possessed of a prodigious memory, an inquiring mind, and restless energy, he excelled in his studies. His classmates said he read 14 hours a day, devouring works of classical literature, history, philosophy, and science. With money he earned from tutoring and saved by skimping on meals, he bought books, lots of books, so many that friends helped carry them home, and he never stopped. One of his biographers described his library. The books sprawled over onto the floor, crowded onto the great oaken table, flooded out of the study and down the stairs, swarmed up the attic, filled the closets, the bedroom, and the parlor. There were thousands and thousands of them, but he knew them all. No field of learning was ignored. After he died, his books became the core collection of the newly opened Boston Public Library. From a young age, he knew he wanted to be a minister. Upon finishing college, he entered Harvard's Divinity School. His first settlement was with a small congregation in West Roxbury, near Boston. While there, he began attending meetings of what came to be known as the Transcendental Club. This was a group of young Unitarian radicals, most of them ministers or former ministers, who were critical of Orthodox Unitarian theology and worship. They discussed new views, as they called them, of religion and philosophy emanating from Britain and Europe. These were heralded by romantic writers such as Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Thomas Carlyle, and German philosopher Immanuel Kant. They also discussed new views of the Bible, advocated by German scholars, which undermined the infallibility of the Gospels. These views set the radicals at odds with their Unitarian elders. Simmering tensions came to a boil over Ralph Waldo Emerson's address to the senior class at the Divinity School in 1838. In this controversial address, Emerson questioned the validity of Jesus' miracles, the personhood of God, and the teachings of the church. He said that God is immanent in the world, not apart from it. Revelation, he argued, was not a long-ago, one-time event. It is continuous and more likely to be found in nature than in the words of the Bible. Andrews Norton, the Pope of the Unitarians, condemned Emerson's remarks as the latest form of infidelity. Parker stirred controversy himself with a sermon he delivered for the ordination of a ministerial colleague in 1841, entitled Transient and the Permanent in Christianity. Drawing upon his extensive knowledge of other religions and cultures, Parker concluded that the forms of religion, creeds, scriptures, and rituals are mutable, changing over time. With respect to Christianity, this is no more evident than in the case of the Trinity, a doctrine concocted at the Council of Nicaea 3 centuries after the death of Jesus, and now rejected by the Unitarians as unscriptural. What is more, the claims of Christianity rest no more on the authority of Christ than the axioms of geometry rest on the personal authority of Euclid. Even if Jesus had never lived, Parker said, the truths he taught, his doctrines respecting man and God, the relation between man, and man and God, with the duties that grow out of that relation, are always the same and can never change. This is the difference between the Christianity about Jesus as opposed to the Christianity of Jesus. While this might not seem so controversial today, it was anathema to many of his fellow Unitarian clergy who ostracized him and refused to exchange pulpits with him. To relieve the strain, Parker and his wife Lydia sailed for tour of Europe. Even after they returned, he remained in ministerial purgatory until a group of Bostonian men gathered to resolve that the Reverend Theodore Parker shall have a chance to be heard in Boston. They organized the 28th Congregational Society, which met at the Melodeon Theater. When this venue proved too small to accommodate the crowds that flocked to hear him preach, the congregation moved to the massive music hall nearby. For Parker, the essence of Christianity was service to humanity, in particular to laboring people, the poor and the marginalized in society. In a sermon on the true idea of the Christian church, he proclaimed, "A Christian church should be the means of reforming the world, of forming it after the pattern of Christian ideas." He gathered a council of reformers to organize opposition to capital punishment, the incarceration of women and children for petty offenses, and low wages paid to working people. The passage of the Fugitive Slave Law in 1850, requiring the return of escaped slaves to the South, brought a new sense of urgency to the abolitionist cause. In addition to his powerful sermons condemning slave owners and their northern collaborators, Parker organized vigilance committees and harbored fugitive slaves in his house. He led an unsuccessful attack on a courthouse to free Anthony Burns, a fugitive slave who had been captured by slave hunters. He was indicted for offending against the peace and dignity of the United States, but was never brought to trial. He helped raise funds to purchase rifles for free state settlers in Kansas, fending off attacks from pro-slavery forces, and was a member of John Brown's Secret Committee of Six, privy to Brown's plans to foment an anti-slavery rebellion. In opposition to the Fugitive Slave Law and the U.S. Constitution, which endorsed slavery and gave slaveholders undue political power, Parker cited a higher law enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, which in his view superseded the Constitution. Slavery was a moral wrong. It was a crime against nature and humanity. It was an intuitive fact, a transcendental truth. In sermon after sermon, he railed against Southern slaveholders and their Northern sympathizers. Because of this, he was called the best-hated man in America. For his own protection and that of the fugitive slaves he took into his home, he kept a loaded revolver on his desk. Adding to the burden of preaching to thousands of people each week, he also rode the Lyceum lecture circuit throughout New England and the Middle West, giving as many as 40 lectures a month. If that wasn't enough, he founded, edited, and wrote for the Massachusetts Quarterly Review. He drove himself. He didn't know how to relax or take a break. His unrelenting pace began to take a toll on his health. At the age of 47, he reckoned himself a man of 60. While lecturing in upstate New York in the late 1850s, he came down with pleurisy, an inflammation of the lungs which took him 8 months to recover from. He began coughing up blood, a sure indication of consumption at the time, one of the leading causes of death in New England. In search of better health, Parker and his wife went to the West Indies in January 1859. A few months later, they sailed for Europe, ending up in Florence, where Parker died in May 1860. Of him, Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "He was willing to perish in the using. He sacrificed the future to the present, was willing to spend and be spent, felt himself to belong to the day he lived in, and had too much to do that he should be careful for fame." In his own day, Parker was widely known, if not notorious, for his preaching, writing, and reform efforts. Not so much today. Anonymously, however, his legacy continues in our national discourse. In the well-known phrase from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, "Of the people, for the people, and by the people," was taken from one of Parker's sermons sent to Lincoln by a friend. And more recently, Martin Luther King Jr. paraphrased Parker's words when he declared, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." Those words were woven into a rug in the Oval Office of the White House during Barack Obama's presidency. For all the wrongs Parker held our country to account for, slavery, a war of aggression against Mexico, the exploitation of the laboring classes, the removal of native populations, the ill treatment of poor and marginalized people, the lack of women's rights, in spite of it all, he had faith that these wrongs would in the end be righted. The quote was taken from a sermon Parker delivered in 1853. In that sermon, Parker said, "Look at the facts of the world. You see a continual and progressive triumph of the right. I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one, and my eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." He surveyed the fall of the tyrannies of church and state in the centuries leading up to his own. The name of justice, of rights of man, shook down their theories, their thrones, and organized victory at every step, he said. He was confident that in the same spirit, the evils of his own day, slavery, injustice, inequality, would be confronted and dealt with. Was Parker's confidence justified? Was he naive to believe that the moral arc of the universe bends toward justice? Do we have grounds for being optimistic about the future? Steven Pinker, author of Better Angels of Our Nature, argues that indeed we do. The thesis of his book is that our era is less violent, less cruel, and more peaceful than any previous period of human history. He marshals a convincing amount of evidence to make his case. The rate of death from war and murder has dramatically declined over the centuries. As violent as the 20th century was, it was less so than previous centuries. The same can be said for other measures of human progress. Generally speaking, today people live longer, are better educated, and healthier than ever before. Political rights have been extended to women, to racial and sexual minorities. Of course, all of these signs of progress don't mean much to a person today who is homeless, incarcerated for minor offenses, prevented from voting, or denied health care. Civil war, genocide, repression, and terrorism persist, if on a lower scale than previously. The toxic effects of racism and white privilege lead many people to wonder if the moral arc isn't bending the other way. Parker would agree that process is not a given. In that sermon, he also said, "In human affairs, the justice of God must work by human means. Continued progress requires concerted actions of all kinds, including protest, charitable work, community organizing, voting, and legislation. It also requires faith, a willed optimism that together we can bend the moral arc toward justice. It does not bend all by itself." Our country has been through difficult and divisive times. The problems that Parker and King confronted persist. They recognize that American exceptionalism is not a given. It is a work in process toward building a more perfect union. At the same time, it is important to acknowledge that thanks to their efforts and the efforts of so many others, then and since, significant progress has been made. And it would dishonor their memories to suggest otherwise. Amen. Thank you.